Welcome to Intersections, the podcast where two experts explore and explain the important policy issues facing us today. We're part of the Brookings Podcast Network, and I'm your host, Adriana Pita. The U.S. is a really big country, so while we often talk about how the U.S. economy is doing, within the big picture of the U.S. economy, different regions are doing better or worse than others, and within those regions, different cities and neighborhoods are struggling or succeeding. To figure out how to improve economic opportunities and outcomes in struggling areas, we need to understand why different regions are doing better than others. And the legacy of racial segregation and the effects of structural racism is an important component of these regional economic disparities. So with us today to help explore this are Bradley Hardy, an associate professor at the Department of Public Administration and Policy at American University, and also a non-resident senior fellow in economic studies here at Brookings, and Frederick Wary, professor of sociology, Princeton University, with a particular focus on the relationship that individuals have with money and financial institutions and how they experience debt. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for being here today.
I'm really happy to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Bradley, I wanted to start with you because you've recently authored a new paper, The Historical Role of Race and Policy for Regional Inequality, and you have two co-authors on that, Trevon Logan at Ohio State and John Parman at William &
Mary.
That's
right, yeah.
Great. So this paper was a really thorough overview of historical segregation and a lot of policies that, whether intentionally or not, had disproportionately negative consequences, particularly for Black communities, but also for other communities of color. And you pointed out that a lot of these policies, like the people that they impact, they're not randomly distributed across the country. They affect certain areas.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, you know, it's really interesting in this paper, we were able to look at the mapping and the distribution of people of color, Black Americans specifically, throughout the U.S. historically. And if you look at those mappings, you can see that Black Americans are located in some of the same counties that are among the poorest in America, the same counties that have some of the lowest patterns of upward mobility across generations. And that's really interesting because you think about the idea of America is that people can come in and relative to their parents, they can do better. They can move up the economic ladder. And so to see that many African Americans, many Black Americans are situated in these locales where mobility across generations appears to be low, it's concerning, but also something that's important to visualize. And it's just the kind of thing that these place-based policies that Fred and I were kind of talking about and considering today, these place-based policies have to consider this context. At least that's what I think. Yeah.
Yeah. You use the term spatial inequality a lot in the paper. Can you tell us a little bit about what that means as distinct just from segregational issues or that sort of thing?
Sure. I mean, I think I'll be able to define it in part. And, you know, you've got a whole host of social scientists who think about this as well, and people have different opinions. But, you know, in part, it's the concept that even in a prosperous metropolitan area or city, take a Boston or Washington, D.C., that you have all sorts of different outcomes, amenities, conditions that are occurring even within that metropolitan area or city. So some neighborhoods look like they have higher quality schools, low crime, a whole host of amenities, while others, maybe even just miles away, are lagging on some of those same variables. And so that's a form of spatial inequality where, you know, just saying that this is a quote-unquote good city, that's kind of a misnomer. And think about that same inequity within a state and then within the nation, right? So which parts of the country, which parts of the state appear to be doing better or worse?
So as you reviewed some of these historical policies that have had lingering effects, there were, of course, plenty that were explicitly racist. You know, the redlining, housing and educational segregation, all like this. But there were also several that you brought up, structures and policies that may not have intended to be discriminatory, but the negative effects did fall disproportionately on racial minorities. Can you talk a little bit about some of those, please?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the policies that really looms large happens to be the administration of welfare policy in America. And so we see that as welfare policy has evolved, and specifically the nation's TANF program, the precursor program was called AFDC. This is what people think of as cash welfare for the poor. Well, you know, this program is devolved to the states and then thereafter to the counties to oftentimes administer. And unfortunately, we've seen instances and there's evidence that caseworkers have discriminated against Black clients. They've sanctioned them off of welfare far more than their white counterpart clients. And this obviously has a whole host of negative consequences for the families. That's just one such example where the policy explicitly wasn't meant to discriminate. That's just a contemporary finding in Florida. It wasn't meant to be discriminatory, but unfortunately, you'll have people who come to the workplace with perhaps their stereotypes, their discriminatory attitudes, and that can have real impacts. Another such policy that we kind of try to highlight in the paper has to do with educational spending. You know, it's interesting, many of the poorest school districts, well, you know, years ago looking at this problem, the finding was that, well, we don't know whether or not spending actually positively impacts school outcomes and educational outcomes. And some of the more modern evidence on this that's been quite sophisticated comes around to the finding that, yes, in fact, you know, putting money into schools, putting money into poor schools has real tangible benefits. This is going to disproportionately positively impact Black students and students of color who are more likely to be situated in these schools. I think one piece of the chapter that's noteworthy, though, is that a lot of the public policies that harm Black Americans are going to harm all of the residents in that local area. So you can have a disproportionate impact on Black Americans that's going to really have negative impacts on the economy overall.
Sure. That sounds very similar. Our colleague Andre Perry wrote a piece not too long ago talking about neighborhood-based discrimination and how the zip code and the neighborhood is now becoming almost as much of a defining factor as race or gender or class issues. Yeah. Is that sort of what you're talking about with this, or is that different?
You know, to a degree. I mean, simply imagine that you are a white child or a white parent situated in a neighborhood where the resource base is less, where the investment in the schools are less. Well, your child is caught up in that same set of negative consequences, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's just something to keep in mind that there's these broader efficiency implications when we don't have these policies being implemented in sort of an equitable way. So no, and I think even more broadly, thinking about the degree to which these same families face a whole range of work-related hardships, how do they weather financial storms? I know this is some of the work that Fred's thought about vis-a-vis credit access. How does that day-to-day process look? How do financial institutions in some of these neighborhoods relate to those potential customers? What are the fees they incur, right?
Right.
So I think it's a broad set of things we try to consider in the paper, and hopefully the readers are interested to go and read more.
Yeah. Fred, this is a good point to turn to you and talk a little bit about some of these disproportionate issues, access to finance, access to banking, all like this.
I'll throw in a fact that's just a fun fact. It's a depressingly fun fact. Mm-hmm. So some sociologists did an experiment, speaking of neighborhoods, in which they decided they were going to sell some old electronics on Craigslist. But they put up a neighborhood marker. And they varied the neighborhood marker so that, you know, if you're coming from a predominantly Black neighborhood, would it affect someone buying a standard electronic product than if you're coming from a white majority neighborhood? What they found, of course, is that it was harder to sell if you had a neighborhood marker from a predominantly Black neighborhood and you're likely to get a lower price. And so there's a sense in which these long-term neighborhood effects, it's not just about sort of do you have access to a job or transportation routes, but there's something really fundamental happening in terms of the way people are ranking the value of what comes out of those places and the way that they're evaluating the people who live in those places. Now, this should be especially concerning to us because we also know that in neighborhoods of disadvantage, on the one hand, we used to look at unemployment rates in a census tract, and you've got a lot of contiguous census tracts with a high joblessness. That looked really bad. Yeah. What looks worse is when you look at people who either have subprime scores or no scores at all. And there, even if you're working, you may have a subprime score. And so you have some neighborhoods. There was a recent mapping done out of the Boston Fed where some neighborhoods, every other household, either there was no one in the household with a credit score or they had subprime credit. And so what does it mean when you grow up in an environment where half of the people around you, they can't access standard financial products?
Yeah.
What does it mean for the way you think about your sense of belonging in that society and the way that you participate in that society when half the people in the neighborhood, all got bad credit? And so one of the things that happens is that it really changes the menu of choices for people in these communities. So on the one hand, they get a lot of advice with financial literacy about please avoid high-cost alternative financial services like payday lenders. But they're in neighborhoods where no one else is providing the types of services they need.
Right.
And so here you start to see an emergence of an America that is quietly separate and unequal because most of us don't walk around with our credit scores tagged to our foreheads. And if we did, I think people would be sort of horrified at how it concentrates. Now, on the one hand, it's a sad story about the concentration of disadvantage and how it intensifies in a very quiet and invisible way. On the other hand, we can also think about credit scores as something that was supposed to be a form of liberation. So there was supposed to be something that was going to sort of not take race into account, right, something that's going to allow people to make better decisions, and you were going to push out identity in favor of these sort of people who have earned their right to full participation. Mm-hmm. Now, the difficulty with that is that in a recent experiment that Rourke O'Brien at University of Wisconsin and Barbara Kivyat at Harvard, they looked at over 1,000 hiring professionals, and they presented them with resumes. And one of the things they did with this experiment is they basically said, so what is the suggested starting salary that you would give for the person with this resume? Now, if you have a white male and a black male, and they're alike in every way possible, and they have a subprime credit score versus a prime credit score, when you're looking at the subprime credit score, someone, same score, same credentials, same work experience, the white males are getting recommended higher starting salary than the black males in the study. Mm-hmm. And so the thing that should have made them equal simply provided additional justification for the lower salary. And so that we can get what we think is objective information and have it filtered in really different ways by virtue of race, and have it concentrated in really different ways by virtue of neighborhood.
You're working on a current project right now about financial citizenship. Is this getting at this? Tell us what you mean by that.
Yes, financial citizenship. So this is a book I'm working on. We just finished the book with
Kristen. Congratulations. That's great. Finishing things is great.
Yes. Finishing things is great. You know, the proofs are on their way. Like, right, okay. So it's with Kristen Seafeld at University of Michigan and Anthony Alvarez at California State Fullerton. And one of the things that we explore in this book is we start asking about how do people participate in social life in the U.S.? And so to what extent is credit and having credit visibility a way in which they are then sort of participating in society? And we do this based on work that we did with the Mission Asset Fund out in California. And so from that, we sort of start to see these themes emerge of not only are people sort of wanting the visibility of the credit score, implicitly, they also want some protections from exploitation. So there's a sense of we should have a right to safety. When we think about what is at the core of citizenship is we think I'm a citizen of this country, therefore I will be at least protected from enemies foreign and sometimes domestic. Mm-hmm. The other thing that then emerges is for me to participate as an adult, I need to be treated like an adult who can make sort of legitimate decisions for myself and my family. And that's the area where particularly people of color seem to run into the biggest obstacles. And so there's a sense that they simply don't know what they're doing. And there's not a discussion of how those strategies actually map onto the institutional environments in which they live. And so this is why we decided, let's sort of talk about what people are doing when they're managing their money. And part of it is about sort of asserting autonomy, and the other part is really about a sense of dignity and respect and taking care of loved ones.
Yeah. That's actually, I was going to save this question until a little bit later, but since you brought this up, when you look at international development aid or your foreign aid, that kind of thing, so many studies have shown that direct cash transfers are the best way to get people help because people know what they need. They know whether this month they need more for rent or if they need more for the doctor or their car needs to be fixed. I was going to ask you both to weigh in, but there's that tension between cash might be the most efficient way of delivering it, but there's the political will and capacity about how you design programs to help give people the support they need. And then also the dignity question of people don't want to feel like they're lining up for a handout. So how do you balance these issues when you're trying to design policy?
My thinking on this actually connects quite nicely to what Fred was just discussing. And I've got work with collaborators, Sandy Darity, Jonathan Mordick, and Derek Hamilton. And we're really trying to understand what we think of as wealth along with your income level and the volatility of income. And so we're trying to document specifically households that have very volatile incomes that are jumping up and down, maybe because their job situations are changing. We know in the U.S., most people and households are going to experience job loss. This is much more acute in the low and moderate income work sector and for people of color. that sort of volatility along with low wealth and relatively low incomes, right? So when those three things are occurring at the same time, you know, what does that look like? What's your ability to cope with events? And so in a lot of our work, it doesn't touch directly on banking, but you can see the clear policy implications that many working families, black families specifically, but also white families, where you start to look at that middle of the income distribution, many of them, roughly half perhaps, if they had a $400 expense, and this is data from the Federal Reserve, with a $400 expense, our analysis suggests that they're not saying that they would be able to pay this off through their checking or savings account, nor would they pay it on a credit card and then pay that balance off within a month. Mm-hmm. Now, no data are perfect, right? Mm-hmm. And so we try to look at this using multiple data sources. But that kind of survey response, where you look at that same household and they report many of them not even having $5,000 in savings. When we talk about wealth accumulation, oftentimes we're visualizing like very conspicuous forms of wealth and maybe, you know, top one, top five, top 10 percenters. But, you know, what about this just sort of ability to buffer or insure against an unanticipated event? And so then when you can't do that, that's going to put you in contact with the financial services industry, with the banking system. And this is where I think this national phenomenon or snapshot becomes local. You know, what are your local options? Maybe the payday loan becomes the best of a set of bad alternatives. If you're also thinking about providing food, housing, utilities, you're making these choices very quickly. And so it's like national phenomenon that has local policy implications. What are we going to do? And then to your question about income support then, I've studied the transfer system and income support policies quite a bit. And I absolutely can see where today's workers are more likely to work with SNAP food stamps and to benefit from some earned income tax credits. And that's a lot to do with stagnant flat wages. I think liquidity matters, though. I think that the TANF system today in many states does not provide much cash assistance. And that doesn't have to be. That's a state policy choice. And so my own view is that I agree families don't want to be permanently dependent on that sort of cash assistance. But there are times, even temporarily so, when if you are between jobs and if you're not qualifying for full unemployment benefits, even if you're trying to upgrade your skills, right, go back to school, that some forms of liquidity, right, to your point about the evidence, can make a real difference. And maybe it's not forever, but to have that insurance mechanism, many of us in this room, we could do it privately. Mm-hmm. But other folks, you know, I think it matters. And that's where you have local choices. The block grant structure allows for states to make choices on those allocations.
Now, this is why one of the things I tell my students to do is we do a sort of do the math. So when we did the math, we basically had them sit down with a, you know, let's look at a budget. And if your income, your inflows, have not increased over the last 10 years, they're pretty flat. But then let's look at how much your rent has increased over the last even 5 years. Mm-hmm. Let's look at how much your child care has increased. Let's look at any associated fees with school. And so you have these standard sort of outlays that have increased significantly over the last 10 years. Income has not. And so one of the difficulties is that we seem to be unwilling in this country to have a conversation about, if we're really talking about doing the math, let's do the math and let's ask, what do you do if 10 years ago you were just barely making it paycheck to paycheck and your rental costs and your childcare costs were much lower? What do you do if you have parents who have an inadequate retirement? And so when something goes wrong, are you going to tell them, sorry, you can't get that medicine? What are you going to do? Yeah. And so part of it is, on the one hand, we like being realist, except in the area of giving poor people and moderate income people credit for, in fact, doing a lot with very little. So when I think about models for things that I think have worked well, I mean, you brought up their earned income tax credit. Yeah. One of the things that people are really proud of when they get that earned income tax credit is they say, I earned this, and I'm going to make some decisions about it. And they end up putting quite a bit of it into sort of a rainy day fund. But they also are able to give their kids a few moments of, I want you to feel like you're a kid. Yeah. So one of the difficulties that we have is that on the one hand, we sort of have this notion that, you know, if you're getting any kind of benefit, you can't have your children be children. You can't have a nice birthday cake, right? That's all frivolous. But then if we're only working to accumulate, and there's also that criticism of why did you give so much to your church? And sometimes we've interviewed people about their expenses, and then we at the end of the interview, because they've been talking about their faith in God, and we'll say, well, didn't you give some money to the church? Of course I gave to the church, but that's not an expense. Like, they look at you as a researcher as if you're crazy because you have forgotten to be human. And so one of the difficulties, I think, in the policy discussion is whenever we're talking about providing any form of assistance to someone who is low or moderate income, we forget that these are human beings with families who are making some pretty reasonable choices. It doesn't mean that sometimes people don't mess up. I mean, God knows in my early days, I had some mess ups, but I also had sort of a pretty good outlook for what my income would look like in the future, and I fixed it, right? And so they don't get an opportunity to learn by doing. There's no room for error, and anything that they do that sort of looks as if it conforms to a stereotype, it confirms our bias. And often when they do things that sort of look as if it's pretty extraordinary, we think it's either a fluke or this person is very unlike the others. Right. And so this is one of the difficulties when we're having policy discussions is that we have just stripped away the humanity of anyone who doesn't conform to a pretty sort of upper middle class model of lifestyle.
I liked your full citizenship point, you know, in terms of that frame of thinking about it. And I think that there's an opportunity to do local interventions, even, for example, the workforce system. So can we think about a safety net for people who go back and try to do the upskilling? Now, there's programs. WIOA has a disadvantaged worker pot, but we can do more there. We can be more innovative about thinking about how we connect local workers with the opportunities to get the jobs that are going to pay better, right? Get them out of near poverty, right? You know, just because you're not poor, a few dollars above the poverty line, you're not doing well. And so that's a way to have these interventions take on the tenor of moving up the economic ladder, right? I think this is, you know, really important.
Absolutely. When we're looking at the long-running effects of racial segregation, it's been really pernicious. So even though the laws that established segregation and supported it don't exist anymore and that there are laws that explicitly outlaw it, these patterns persist. As you said, a lot of the, you know, the concentrations of poverty and particularly of poverty amongst communities of color have not changed in decades in many ways. But then there's also this issue of income segregation, and that income segregation has been on the rise even within racial groups.
Sure.
Can you talk a little bit about this problem and what's going on with that?
You know, I will. And in part, I want to go back to something Fred talked about earlier. He was talking about how he has his students think through essentially the household balance sheet and the different expenses and costs they face. I think this is really interesting because the challenge and the puzzle for place-based policy interventions in part is that we do see this sorting in America where you have increasingly high-income, highly educated families situating themselves in specific neighborhoods and counties. And this starts sort of this process where those schools have more resources. They are the more desirable areas to live. They then consequentially start to cost more. Now, there are ways in which we could increase the supply of housing, but at any particular point in time, you see this playing out. And so your question about segregation then becomes really challenging when we think about place-based policies, because let's suppose you want to locate in one of these prosperous counties or prosperous parts of the county where you see the high-quality schools, lower crime. In the absence of maybe, for example, a housing voucher, which happens to be oversubscribed right now, it's going to be very difficult for these families to afford, and I'm going to isolate on housing as a part of the budget, right? These places are more desirable for a reason. They're more expensive. This is a real challenge. And so to your segregation point, I mean, we see this playing out. There have been multiple scholars to highlight this economic segregation. I mean, I will tell you that, yes, you could look at economic segregation, not just racial segregation, and you know, this plays out as absolutely families of color, black families that can oftentimes afford to situate themselves in these prosperous neighborhoods can and will do so. unfortunately, due to a whole host of structural factors and historical factors, depending on if you count people or families, anywhere from a quarter to a third of Black Americans are at or below poverty. So this still has, you know, the ocular analysis is going to really play out along racial dimensions largely. But I think your point absolutely stands that this is as much an education and income piece as it is racial. But unfortunately, those things seem to kind of flow along similar lines where it looks like racial segregation.
Yeah. You mentioned, I think this came up in the paper, that particularly for certain Black neighborhoods, and it was particularly amongst a lot of the Rust Belt cities, mm-hmm. they're having the depopulation problem of that people have, as they've done better economically, of course, there was white flight in the 70s, but then uh-huh. even Black families, as they did better, they moved out. And so now there just isn't a population base in those cities at all anymore.
Sure.
Can you explore that just a little bit more?
Yeah, and I guess one thing to add to this is that there's been fascinating research, and again, this is where this chapter really does focus on race and policy, and it's worth noting that even in an area like Appalachia, there's been really great research by scholars, including at the University of Kentucky, who essentially found that a lot of the big predictors of economic growth ultimately were, for Appalachia, proximity to the larger cities in Appalachia, and that you really did have this within country, within the U.S. version of sort of a skills drain where a lot of the talent and a lot of the energy was sort of bleeding out of the smaller parts of Appalachian USA to the larger city centers. Think larger cities in Pennsylvania, for example, right? Or Ohio. And so I think that this is certainly an issue that is problematic across race, frankly. And so for the people who are left behind, what do you do? You know, one of the challenges related to what I believe to be among the most promising results that we've seen in terms of policy interventions moving to opportunity, some of the long-term evidence with moving to opportunity, which involved providing vouchers for folks to move to more economically advantaged communities, we basically found in some of the more recent studies there that there are a host of long-term economic benefits. But a challenge is that, and I think you're alluding to this, many people won't move. We won't be able to move them. And so what do we do for folks who are going to remain? And I think this is a puzzle. Part of what we're doing in the paper is documenting some of this depopulation that's occurring. But I think that larger volume is trying to tackle what to do.
Right. Well, that gets at the big gentrification question. You have to ask that. How do you then move people to these underserved and underfinanced neighborhoods to bring in amenities, to entice businesses, but not do it in such a rapid, overwhelming change that you end up kicking out all of the people who used to live there?
Sure.
What are some of the options there? How do you deal with that?
I mean, unfortunately, as neighborhoods become more attractive, for some reason, there's not more of an insistence on things like mixed-income housing. There's not enough of an insistence on these developers providing other types of amenities that will be enjoyed by everyone in the community. And so it's not that it can't be done. It's just often neglected. I think one of the other challenges, too, is as a neighborhood starts to rapidly appreciate in its real estate, it also starts to attract more police attention. Because if you have a bunch of well-off individuals moving into a neighborhood, they don't want to be robbed and they don't want to fear being robbed. And so what you're likely to then have is more police who are present, and because they need to sort of make sure that they are demonstrating that they provide value, mm-hmm. you have kids who are just being kids who aren't really a threat but who are now more likely to come into contact with law enforcement in ways that they might not have been before. And so I don't know that there are any clear-cut pronouncements from the mountain, because part of the difficulty is that you need enough political will to force people to, as we say back in South Carolina, to do right. And often we don't have that political will. We don't have the political leadership of saying, okay, you're coming in to develop, but you need to do right.
No, I mean, I would piggyback on that. There are times when these interventions just can't help but escape the need for greater resources and, in my view, greater revenue. So these are local problems that do beg for additional resources, financial resources, right? So the commitment to providing a stock of affordable housing. That's a zoning challenge, and you might want to get private developers involved. But whether and how you can provide vouchers that are competitive for some of these expensive local markets, can the voucher be an entitlement? Right now, housing is not an entitlement. Food stamps are. But if you can qualify for housing benefits and be way in the back of the line, right? Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, this is the biggest bite of the household balance sheet, like Fred was talking about. So I do think there's things we can do. And then to Fred's point about some of the cultural clashes that are occurring, this is an additional complication that those neighborhood preferences start to shift. What was perhaps just simply people enjoying themselves starts to look like a community nuisance. And I think this has big implications for trust in local government. You know, some of my colleagues in public administration and policy, Jeff Winger, Vicky Wilkins, Jocelyn Johnston, they talked a lot about this notion of street-level bureaucrats. And so how do we interface with our local government? You know, what do we think about when we think of the local government? I might think of a city council member. I might think of the DMV. But in many communities, the local government can oftentimes be law enforcement. And so how are those interactions occurring? And for place-based policy, I think it does matter a lot because you're talking about trust in local institutions. How are you going to come in and do a place-based policy if you don't have that trust? And so obviously we're seeing a lot of this in the country. And I think to Fred's point, some of these clashes can make these sorts of efforts more difficult.
Sure. I also wanted to ask you a little bit about, and I wasn't sure what to call it, whether it's about knock-on effects or if it's sort of unintended consequences. And what I'm getting at in this particular case, it was looking at the education issue. So when you look at low-income neighborhoods or about you want to say we want to improve STEM education mm-hmm. for Black and Latinx students. So great, we improved high school graduation rates, we've improved college attainment, and now Black students are carrying a much higher burden of debt than white students are. How do we go about trying to maybe, I don't know if it's a question of foreseeing that there is going to be a multi-step, you know, this isn't just a case of getting a better education, we're going to have to deal with the financing and the education piece, or then reacting to them when it does turn out like, oh, we were trying to help, that didn't go as well as we hoped.
Yeah, this is interesting. I mean, so I won't claim to have silver bullets here, but a couple of points. Some interesting research by Fenaba Addo at Wisconsin, and she does identify the very thing you're talking about, which is that much of the wealth gap racially between Blacks and whites can be explained by education debt, mm-hmm. right? And so the real challenge here then is that many Black households are, metaphorically, I like football, they're running the playbook, so to speak, that we've told them to run, which is to go and upgrade their skills, invest in higher education. Again, not a silver bullet, but I will say one piece of this is that these communities are also heavily marketed from for-profit educational providers. Mm-hmm. We have a victory that we can claim with respect to matriculation. Many more low-income and Black high school students are going to college. We now have a graduation gap that is a real issue. And I've got some work with Dave Marcotte at American University looking at this issue. So you go, you get half of a credential, you don't graduate, you have the debt. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get treated like a college grad, not going to get a college grad type job. Right. You're going to have that debt. And that's not even accounting for many folks who are first gen and don't have the knowledge can be marketed to go and purchase what is really a low quality for-profit credential. They're not all low quality, let me be clear, but many of them don't yield the positive labor market outcomes, and they're quite expensive. And so I'm not saying that that's everything, but it's a lot of what's going on. And the marketing, not just to Black Americans, but to veterans who are returning, mm-hmm. it's quite aggressive. Mm-hmm. And it actually speaks to some of the everyday life issues that Fred was discussing. People who are working hard, who have families, who need some flexibility. Mm-hmm. So that's a strong marketing ploy. And it leads down some really troubling roads.
Yeah, and it also seems that even if a person has a pretty decent education loan, if you're Black or Latinx, you're probably going to pay for a lower monthly payment. Mm. So the longer it takes you to pay that thing off, the more it costs.
Yep.
Why are you going to opt for a lower monthly payment? Because especially if you're first generation and you finally got out of college, the first thing that you want to do is you want to sort of demonstrate love and care for those who have supported you while you went through that experience. Because maybe you had even a full scholarship or a partial scholarship. You know that at home, people were making sacrifices to help you get through all of the rest. Mm-hmm. And the first thing they want to do is, I want to do something for mom. I want to do something for dad or auntie or granny or sister or siblings. And so in order to do that, you need to have a little bit more per month in the wallet to sort of help the family out. And so you have this other practice of paying back a little less than you could compared to your white counterparts because some of them are going to just have fewer people in the network who require assistance. And so the extent to which we have this network effect of the more people you have in the network who might need assistance and you now have the capacity to help, the more you're going to have going out and therefore not sort of paying off more quickly the loan. And so there are a lot of different ways that education debt starts to widen that wealth gap. It doesn't mean that it's not worth doing.
I love that point, though. I love that. You got to go, right? Like the returns are still positive.
Returns are still positive. You're going to still have some wealth. But when we're talking about closing wealth gaps, well, I think that the difficulty is we're so sort of tacking it on to individuals and individual strategies. The wealth gap, for it to be as big as it is, you can't on your own have a gap that big. I don't care if you're super. You can't Superman or Superwoman your way into a gap that big.
Right.
It required really deliberate policies to create such huge gaps.
So Fred keeps bringing the interesting things up that reminds me of also in this issue of student debt. I mean, one, you do have what in my view has been essentially a 30-year or so tax revolt that we've been engaged in nationally. So there's been a decommitment to subsidizing public education as much as we should at the post-secondary level. But then also this notion of those redlining policies and those historical policies that you discussed briefly at the beginning, well, that has all sorts of long-running consequences. Which families have the capacity to provide that down payment for a home, to wipe out that education debt? And that matters, right? And so that's nobody's fault technically in the contemporary era, right? Mm-hmm. In my own view, but that's something that occurs, that's an inequity, that's a legacy, and it's having impacts.
Yeah, and the worst thing is when a parent dies, funerals are expensive, and to have to gather $7,000 to $10,000 all of a sudden. And they do it. The way they do it, we won't say, right? So part of it is you've got a high-cost lender here, you've got people who are selling off assets. They're doing whatever it takes. Because you want to live a life of dignity, and you care about how you send off your loved ones. It's just important. We have two legs and not four, and sometimes we forget that. And so somehow we refuse to be realistic about this is what it takes to live in this country and to live with your head lifted up. And if people don't have institutional means to meet those obligations so that they can walk with their head up, they're going to find another way that's going to be really costly. And so if we don't want them to do that, then it's up to us as a society to say, actually, we can generate other types of programs, products, services. We can generate other forms of safety in the consumer market so that people can walk with their heads lifted up. Maybe they're in debt, but they can be in debt with a sense of dignity. It's up to us.
It makes sense.
Well, Bradley, I really want to commend your paper to our listeners for not only being a very thorough overview in its own right of a lot of these issues, you know, walking through education and incarceration and housing and segregation, all this.
You read the paper.
I did. but it's also really fantastic for someone who maybe they think that they know the basics because you were always directing to other studies. You know, so like highways had an effect on housing issues in cities. Here's these three different studies that looked at this.
Yeah.
So I really want to commend it for that reason, that it's a great place for people who want to know where to go next after they get that basic overview.
Yeah, I mean, it's a start. And there's been so much work across the social sciences, sociology, history, economics on these topics. In a sense, it was a fun project, but it was also really challenging because we had this page limit and we could only do so much, right?
Right.
So it is a start. And I do think it's important that folks know that there's actual evidence.
Yeah.
And oftentimes these topics, I think, are thought of as conjectures
or
anecdotal evidence. But there's been serious scholarship on these things, and we hope to try to bring at least some of that out.
Great. Well, thank you both very much for being here and being with us today and explaining this. And I recommend to our listeners to go and find your paper. We'll have the links in the show notes. And hopefully we'll see your financial citizenship book come out soon. Do you know what's the date on that?
They're estimating April 2019, Financial Citizenship from Below, Russell Sage Foundation.
Very nice.
All right. Great. Well, gentlemen, thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having us. Right. Yeah.
Thanks for listening. You can find more episodes of Intersections and the rest of the Brookings Podcast Network on Apple or Google Podcasts, on Spotify, CastBox, Stitcher, or your other favorite podcast app. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter @PolicyPodcasts for news and updates.